This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekiness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Whitten.
Are we talking adult like Torchwood or adult like Cinemax after 11 p.m.?
And with me are Melissa Mazza.
What are scissor grenades? I want one.
And Keir Hansen.
Gallifrey Public Radio. Now we have maths.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But if we get into anything too serious, don't worry. We'll warn you again. Welcome to episode 68 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we're still smiling, still positive, still standing loyal behind all the Who episodes, like members of our own families, even the slow, boring members who go on and on, seemingly without a point to be made. No, we stand by them and defend them wholeheartedly, wearing their ridiculous clothes, lacking any sort of charm or sense of urgency. Where was I again?
It doesn't matter. It's not important.
No, this week we are continuing with our finding the good in the bad episodes arc, our silver linings. I am Jay, and with me this week are Keir and Melissa. Keir, how's it going, sir?
Very good, sir. Very good.
And Melissa, how are you tonight?
I am great. How are you tonight?
I'm doing good. So this week we took on the brave task of looking into not only the Curse of the Black Spot, but also Time Lash, which... Time Lash has been systematically voted in like the very, very bottom of most of the polls. It's 199th in the Mighty 200th poll. In the IO9 ranking of every Doctor Who story ever, it is the absolute bottom. This one is, you know, is categorically a bad episode.
Yes, but all the more reason for us to be able to say if we really are true fans of the form and of the program, we can find the positive elements in here that while we may still not recommend the episode to someone who's kind of dipping their feet in some more obscure Who history, we can at least say if you come across it, it's okay. We've got a few things that you can take away from it that will not leave you clawing at your eyes and ears.
Yeah, this one was it was a bit rough. I want to say that a lot of the reason why it was so difficult to get through was because, like, last week we had Terminus, which was just all over the place, completely sporadic. I mean, it had no sense of anything going on until towards the very end. This one had more of a storyline. It knew what it was doing. It was just harder to get through for some reason, and I think that a lot of that reason is because of the timing. Where, you know, Terminus, we have four episodes that are, you know, 22 minutes long. This one, at least in the format that I got it, I don't know if this is how it aired, but it's two episodes that are 44 minutes long.
It did actually air as a four episode story, okay. But a lot of the distribution, because of the DVD release, I believe, had it consolidated to two episode installments to go along with commentary, which is gold in and of itself. Because when you get the crew together to talk about what has been, you know, trounced on for decades as being a categorical prime example of what was bad about Who in the 80s, and you've set them to task to explain their art, you're going to get some fascinating comment, which we'll get into. But Time Lash, as far as Colin Baker's performances and Sixth Doctor traveling with Perry, are all the things you would normally expect an episode from that era to be. You know, bickering between the Doctor and the Companion, because that's the kind of relationship they had. You know, sets that strained a limited budget, because they were at a point in terms of production cycle where the show was getting upstaged by other productions the BBC was putting on, and their budget was getting tightened farther and farther. And a fledgling writer who had written a couple of other things for the BBC as far as some of their other dramatic series, but this was the first foray into writing sci-fi. and his shows. So for those people who are unfamiliar, or, you know, God help you if you never have to come across this episode, whole premise behind Time Lash is that Dr. and Perry end up having to deal with a society under the thumb of a cruel dictator, of course, as most dictators are. And the dictator happens to be someone that has crossed paths with the Doctor before.
Yeah.
That's about all you need to know. Oh, and then the giant time tunnel Christmas tree. Other than that.
Yeah, it's just basically like a wormhole that sends people back to, I think, like the Middle Ages in Scotland.
Yeah, I don't know if the time tunnel, which they refer to as the Time Lash, as a punishment, you know, for those who have offended Borad, not Borat. Just make that clear, Melissa. She was all excited when she first started watching this. He's like, wait a minute, Borat is the enemy in this thing?
Written, like, I hear Borat. I'm sorry.
but their punishment was to be basically, instead of getting airlocked, they would get thrown in the Time Lash, left to drop, I believe, at intermittent points. Like, there was some control over where they would end up landing. But the Doctor actually, at some point, does some calculations to be able to determine the offset and figure out where people end up when they get dumped out. It's an episode that, as Jay mentioned in the intro, it loves to get dumped on for many reasons, most of them justified. You know, it was a kind of a slapdash script. It was not exactly the best acting in the world from a lot of the supporting cast. It was not even really necessarily stellar acting from the headline cast either.
Primary, yeah.
So, but I think we've each collectively been able to find some positive things to be able to say about it, barring a few areas where you just can't help the poor thing. But as Jay did mention, you know, when Doctor Who magazine decided to put out their Mighty 200 poll and rank what then, when they reached their 200th episode airing as far as the series history, they stacked them all up, and this was 199th. We will not yet get into what was number 200 in the Mighty 200 poll. But to give you a little bit of backstory, as far as the writer, Glenn McCoy, he originally was commissioned to write an episode, was given the opportunity to have sort of carte blanche on writing an episode for the series, and wanted to do a Dalek story. And it apparently was so systematically bad. Get this. It was so bad that he wrote this, and this was accepted.
Wow.
There you go.
Man.
Yeah.
What might have been.
Oh, God. Exactly. So, So anyway, and then as I was mentioning about the commentary, if you'd ever get a chance, or if you ever, you know, have the wherewithal, or as Shakespeare would say, chutzpah, to go watch the thing, Baker actually calls out the actor who played Tekker, Paul Darrow, about his very unusual performance. His delivery is not you know, this is your like worm tongue character. You know, this is your little snide,
the power behind the power, kick. Or the. Yeah, basically the second in command, the one that's there just to be in the limelight.
Yes, the yes master, kind of a type. But power gets to his head because he gets to be sort of the enforcer of a lot of the things that the Borad casts down from his secretive chambers. Well, aside from the helium sucking android, but Tekker's performance is so bizarre because he always looks like he's either on a really great acid high through the whole thing, and he's just grinning and disconnected, or his lines are being delivered really, really canned, like campy and hammy as hell. And Baker calls him out on this. You know, they did the commentary about 20 years later, and, you know, he calls him out and says, you know, this is something kind of, you know, it's a very interesting approach that you had there. I had to wonder at times exactly what it was you were thinking. And Tekker actually admitted, or I should say Tekker, Darrow admitted that he wasn't really taking the whole thing seriously. He was kind of saw the whole thing as soon as he started reading the script over. He thought the whole thing was going to be kind of like it was a joke. And he was delivering it as such, and Baker laid into him in the commentary for being unprofessional. You know, that's something that he clearly, you know, to this day, takes very seriously. Yeah. So that alone might be more interesting than watching the episode itself. I had that down as one of the positives, but I didn't actually write it out. But
I don't know, the character of Tekker for some reason reminded me a lot of the. Do you guys remember the Disney version of the Three Musketeers from back in the early 90s?
Vaguely.
With Chris O'Donnell and Charlie Sheen and Kiefer Sutherland.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
The character that D'Artagnan's rival, basically. Yeah, the one that he's sword fighting at the beginning that kind of chases him all through the movie.
Okay, okay.
I can't remember his name now. Incidentally, Paul McGann. Figured that out when I was sitting. Yeah, I was watching with my kids and I saw his name in the credits. I was like, wait a minute, where is he? And then he pops up. I'm like, oh my God. But this character, Tekker, reminded me a lot of that guy for some reason. I don't know. It was just, that's the vibe I was getting from him the whole time. It might have been the hair. I don't know, but I couldn't look at him without thinking that.
Wow.
Anyway. All right. Okay. So let's get into some of the criticisms that people went, and then we'll start in on our positives.
All right. Let me just preface here that I culled all of the criticisms down to what I thought gave the most concise, systematic point by point about some of the things that failed the episode. I waded through pages upon pages of these things because it kind of got to be like it was like the King's Whipping Boy, you know, is where you just chose, oh, I need someone to beat up on. Oh, you can bring Time Lash out here. I need something, you know. It was a little too easy. It was the fish in a barrel kind of a review. So
yeah, it really was.
You start with, you know, one writer starts out and basically kind of summarizes it. You know, this combines a silly plot, overlit and underdesigned sets, mediocre acting, and one of the least convincing monsters of all time. The story's very name has become shorthand for the excesses of the JNT era with its overblown theatrics and sloppy script. For those of you who have not found this out, Time Lash is an anagram for lame. Figure out the rest of the letters. Lame poop.
We know that you're good because you know everybody keeps on coming up with Torchwood being an anagram. You can figure this one out.
There you go.
So the next one that we've got here says that the Time Lash itself is a gaudy nightmare. It's a shame we actually get to see inside it, since it looks like some horrible Chris or Santa's grotto, full of sparkly blue lights, tinsel, and other assorted bits of festive bling.
It was so 80s too. Like, bigger budget, it could have helped, but like, I think it's just the 80s-ness of it is the worst.
No, I don't think a bigger budget would have helped. I think scrapping that idea and going with something completely different is the only way to go with that one.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, when the Time Lash was not activated and it was just that obelisk, it was fine. And a couple of reviewers said, you know, if you didn't show me the interior, if you just showed me people getting thrown at it like from a side view or something and they disappear, that would have been better.
Yeah.
But seeing them fall into the Hall of Tinsel was just redonk. So,
yeah. So, Melissa, what's the next one we got?
The next one is the android speaks in one of those radiophonic affected monotones and moves with all the agility of a man in a straitjacket. Show these sorts of visuals to kids today and you probably won't hear your spluttering protests for deafening laughter. It's too true.
The football shoulder pads, the blue face paint, the blue man group, but he's got the wig from Blade Runner or something on.
And it's like this awful like yellowish green color.
Oh gosh.
I literally was like, oh, come on.
Yeah. I don't know. Or the fact that a lot of the guards that were running around that had the beekeepers helmets yes. on that came down with the belt around their shoulders so they couldn't put their arms up because that belt was strapped around. All right. Before we get too into the negativity here, some of these points were valid. So I want to just point out from a production standpoint, you know, when they critique the actress Crowley, Lara Crowley, I believe, who played Vena, who gets thrown into the Time Lash and sent back to the appropriately to the 1800s. When she glides her way through the story with the expression of a woman who's just been thwacked in the head with a frying pan. Worse still, she reads her lines with all the emotion of an ironing board. This guy's real big on metaphors, by the way. He's dangling on the edge of oblivion is a bad enough line, but in Crowley's hands, it's made doubly worse in that she shows no concern whatsoever. And she really didn't. You know, she had one facial expression, and that was about all that she could manage through the whole thing. They just changed the amount of bruise makeup they put on her to make her look like she's been through an emotional time. Yeah, that was indicative of a lot of the acting that went on through this one. It seemed like a lot of them were just kind of reading the lines, going through the motions, waiting for their check.
Exactly, yeah.
Yes.
So the next one we've got says, when you think about it, was there any element to this story from the time tunnel to Borad's aging weapon that wasn't done better elsewhere?
Valid point.
Yeah.
These were all, and you could tell that's the mark of a youth, or I should say an inexperienced writer, because he's just pulling on a lot of tropes that he knows and a lot of these cliches. So, you know, just kind of work with what he had, and they looked at it and said, well, okay, well, it's safe. You know, it plays on things that have all been time tested. No pun intended.
Right.
But this should all work on paper. This makes sense. So
what's the last movie we've got, Melissa?
It says, had Glenn McCoy produced Time Lash as a school essay, he would have undoubtedly received a grade of C+ with the comment, must try harder. Ouch. Yeah.
Nothing else. I don't know. I think a C plus is a little bit generous, but yeah.
That's true. What is a C plus? Well, that's like an 87 or something.
No. C plus is in the high 70s. But that's the thing. I mean, it's if the average, if the median is a straight C, and you're giving us a C plus, that writer found something in there that said, okay, it was not great, but with effort, this could have been something better. And that was led me to one of the positives I took away from this after sitting through it. You know, and I went through it twice recently now because I'm a glutton for punishment. But I realized if you really take it down and you boil it down, this is the script and everything in it from a skeletal structure could work, but it was like half baked. You know, it was just overly simplified. You know, this was really kind of stripped down to the minimal writing, minimal action, minimal effort, and an ending that kind of got stuck on the last 10 or 15 minutes of it. You know, you get to the situation where you could have wrapped it up one way, but no. So they're going to introduce this whole idea of the villain being cloned and one more opportunity to use what was probably the most costly piece of the entire production, which was the dinosaur puppet.
Yeah. So. Well, I mean, I don't know, though, but what you're saying there is pretty much the same as like, well, you know, we have this house here and it's got horrible, like, you know, poop brown wallpaper. And if we took everything out and pulled up the floors and knocked down the walls and left just the framing studs and then built from there, it could be a decent house. It's like, what are you really left with at that point? Yeah. I mean,
well, like I said, it's one of these ones where you don't need to. It was an encapsulated episode. In fact, it did an excellent job of really not intruding on any of the other surrounding episodes to be considered part of any of the over arcs. It didn't see any great demise or introduction of new companions, with one minor exception of a sort of a pseudo companion. We'll get to him in a minute. But it didn't require a lot of difficult thinking. So if the script wasn't necessarily as bad as it was, just taking the fact that of the way or the construct of how it was written, you could hand this one to somebody and say, well, yeah, this is what the 80s Doctor Who looked like. And you'd say, okay, well, and they'll say, oh, that was bad. Well, don't worry about it, because it doesn't have anything to do with any of the others. So here's some better ones, and you can move on. You don't have, it doesn't require a lot of previous knowledge about how the TARDIS works, or how Time Lord regeneration works, or how, you know, Gallifreyan technology works, or any of those things, because it's too simple to require that.
Yeah.
I guess you can see that as a positive.
Okay.
Well, what else you got? I mean, you've kind of started with your thing, so run us through all your positives here.
Well, except the fact that at least this guy as a writer paid attention to the fact that Perry, before she met the Doctor, was a botanist.
New information.
Yeah,
I seriously did not know that before this episode.
No, that was her background. So this gave her an opportunity for 5 or 10 minutes to say, oh, I'm fascinated by all these alien plants and so forth. And you know, oh, that one's got acid. It'll shoot your face. But it showed that there was at least some connection. It made Perry slightly more three-dimensional. Slightly?
Yeah, I was going to say, with the exception of what happened in the Trial of the Time Lord series, this was the most character development I've ever seen in Perry. And that was just because, oh, she does something other than whine on the TARDIS.
or bicker with the Doctor.
Whining.
Well, that's just the thing. I actually consider that a positive, because some people got a kick out of some of the dialogue across the relationship of Colin Baker and his companions, the fact that he and Perry would constantly be slamming one another. I mean, they bickered like more than, you know, David Addison and what's her face on Moonlighting. You know, there's a dated reference for you. But that was like, that was kind of their thing, was that they would constantly be, you know, just tearing into one another in at times when you really wondered how much of it was in good natured jest. Because the characters got under one another's skin, but it always seemed to work to their advantage because it led them to conclusions that they needed to move forward and what have you. You got plenty of that in this episode, because they just basically slap the crap out of each other for, you know, for 90 minutes or so. I did think, speaking of companions, when they introduced David Chandler as playing Herbert, and are we even concerned about spoilers on this one? Does it even matter to the fact that we're going to mention to everyone that...
I said go for it.
Man who decided to go watch this after we talked about it, and you're upset that we spoiled you, tweet us or something, and we apologize in advance.
Yes. So the introduction of having Herbert George Wells work out the initials for yourself as you know, being one of those historical figures that the Doctor crosses paths with, I thought, and I got it from about, you know, the first moment when he walks in and he's just fascinated by hearing about all the intricacies of the of this strange, you know, temporal disturbance of when Vina comes stumbling into his house there, that I think this is something that we see time and time again in Who, classic and new. You know, the Doctor, in all of his adventures, comes across this one individual who, rather than being stunned, shocked, appalled, terrified by it, becomes fascinated by the world that surrounds, or this new realization of the world beyond what they knew, and it propels them to do incredible things. You know, whether that be modifying the works of Shakespeare or Van Gogh or Van Gogh, however you want to pronounce it, experiences with Leonardo da Vinci that Tom Baker had back in the day, and so forth. This happens all over the place. So why wouldn't it make sense? I thought it was actually kind of a clever element to have the idea of all the little aspects, even down to the mention of the Morlocks and whatnot, that that Herbert is paying such rapt attention to as he's sort of, you know, following the coattails through this entire adventure, contributing nothing. Understood. He just stands there, you know, with his mouth hanging open for about the vast majority of his time on screen.
Yeah.
But I do like the premise of him, of the Doctor being the inspiration for the time machine and everything that follows. So
I'll be honest, I put so little thought into this episode that, like, once I found out that he was H.G. Wells, I didn't go back and reevaluate everything that came before trying to fit that in. And yeah. I was just sitting there watching the episode. I'm like, really? They named them Morlocks? How freaking lazy is this? And it wasn't until you just said that I caught it.
You see? Redemption. But that's just it. I mean, that just showed that, and in my estimation, I think if that's what our writer wanted to do, if McCoy grabbed a hold of that and used that as the underpinning of the episode, I think that would have made a more interesting episode. That would have been something where I wouldn't necessarily call it Vincent and the Doctor, you know, but it would be something where, you know, you get to see, again, similarly to what we dealt with, well, on a much different tangent with Love and Monsters last week, the repercussions of what happens when something as fantastical as the Doctor crosses paths with the average, and I'm using average with big finger quotes here, the average human being, and the impact that it has on their lives, or in this case, spurns creativity. That could have been a really cool premise if that was the central conceit of the episode. And everything else that happened with the Borehead was kind of, you know, the B story. But unfortunately, it got buried in some, well, in Tekker. So, but that brought me to my last point. And I really strained for this one, but I was pretty satisfied with it. Is if you really take the Borehead's performance, he, compared to Tekker, who has far more screen time, you know, through the majority of the episode, the Borehead is a genuinely acceptable, you know, evil dictator character. You know, I like what Ashby did with it, because it was in his kind of, you know, not really monotone, but his very kind of, for the vast majority of the episode, very cool and collected baritone delivery. He was smug. He was the one in charge. He didn't feel that at any point that there was that he was losing control of the situation. Even when things didn't go according to his original plan, he adapted and modified and still had what he felt to be his finger on the pulse of everything that was going on within his domain, including the Doctor, even down to the last couple of minutes. So even though he was given some kind of crap dialogue at times, and some of it was genuinely bad, there were a few lines in there that are very kind of clever and deliver that nice smug, you know, man in power kind of perspective. But he never went overboard, which Tekker did.
Oh, yeah.
Tekker was so far overboard that he came up over the opposite rail.
It's easy to compare them when you have Tekker in the same episode.
Exactly. So that worked to his benefit, I think. I like that aspect of it. So you know, everybody says, oh God, it's so bad. And some people even, you know, go so far as to say it's one of those, I wouldn't call it a guilty pleasure, but it's one of those ones that you can sit back and almost MST3K it. Right.
Yeah, that
because
would,
it,
this would, you know, definitely lend itself to that.
Exactly. So because of the fact that you're dealing with horrible sets, bizarre costumes, you know, rubber puppets, you know, hammy acting, tinsel, weird lighting, and Colin Baker flying off the handle for 90 minutes. It's one of those ones where if you take it as that and say, okay, it's got some, you know, half a dozen sci-fi tropes, and it's almost comedic in its nature. You know, grab your snack, sit back on the couch, and enjoy it.
Yeah,
that was my take. I was all right with this. I was worse off last week than I was this week.
Okay.
Yeah, so I mean, some of the things that I found in it that we touched on it before. The android was hysterically bad.
I don't know what you mean, Jay.
You were a couple octaves deep there, buddy.
my helium balloons from my birthday have gone flat. Sorry.
Yeah, it's to the point where if you take it as a serious thing, you have problems. You know, you cannot look at this thing and be like and expect it to be a serious thing.
It's like this giant steroid ridden Smurf in football gear talking like a cross-dresser version of the GLaDOS operating system from Portal. It's just really, really bizarre.
No, but it doesn't even have the personality of GLaDOS. Oh, no, honestly, the thing that bothered me the most was I was sitting there watching, and the thing that threw me on the android was at one point he smirks. And it's like the only facial expression you get from him. I'm like, that actor f***ed up.
I did not notice Mark.
Anyway, but
Then you probably didn't notice the other scene. There was actually a scene where I believe one of the background characters, one of the extras, is, you know, like they're in a serious situation and they walk past a control panel and they go to turn a knob and the knob comes off in their hands and they jam it back onto the console. Quality.
That's what you do.
They just like knew that this episode was so bad that they didn't even bother doing another take when that happened.
No, just roll it. You know, film costs money.
Oh, and then when we first come across Herbert and he thinks that the doctor is a demon or an evil spirit or something, the whole premise struck me as funny for some reason. I'm amused by this and everything he's doing to try and keep him out. And the doctor's just like, that's very nice. Now move out of my way.
It was. And that again, you know, at least that was a little, well, it might've been a little campy for period, but think about it. I mean, that could have been an acceptable.
Well, I mean, especially since the guy was sitting there messing around with a homemade Ouija board or something. It's like, you know, I thought when I first saw that, I thought that they were being much more brave than anything in the U.S. would have been, like throwing in occult references like that. And then you find out who he is. It's like, oh, okay, that kind of fits in now, I guess.
Yeah.
So when the doctor called Tekker a microcephalic apostate, I lost it. I was like, that is.
They give Baker great quips.
I mean, that was the best insult. I loved it.
Come on, get to it.
All right, so you've got Perry in bondage gear. I'm like, if you add a ball gag, I'm in.
I want a ball gag keep for all reasons.
I saw that. I was like, okay, I'm starting to pay attention to this part. And she starts talking, and I'm checking out again. Anyway, moving along.
They should have made a decision just a long time back. I think one of the central issues that we keep having with Perry and the fact that she always had, you know, her delivery always came out that way, or that she just kind of grated at us, was because she was really, really fighting to maintain an American accent. She was genuinely fighting hard, according, and there were times her, when though, it just could.
Didn't you hear, like, according to her, like, she fooled everyone. Like, everyone thought offset that she really was American.
She's said that in interviews and stuff. I don't know how much I believe it. It may have been true for like the first day until they called cut, and she, you know, like, oh wow, that's okay, whatever.
Anyway,
it's okay. But, the other things, like a personal high point for me is like, I grew up in a very, very religious family. We weren't allowed to do Halloween, so we went to the local churches for the fall festival things.
Okay.
And when the doctor goes inside the time lash, you've got the black with the little sparklies and the tinsel and all that stuff. It reminded me of this like black light tunnel that I went through at a fall festival when I was like 5 years old. And it was the coolest experience that I'd ever had in my life up to that point. And it reminded me of that. I was like, oh, okay, I kind of like this.
Okay.
Festivals too. I used to volunteer at my friend's church every year when they did it. That's so funny that you said that. I almost forgot about those.
And then, I mean, my last thing is like, Herbert grated on me up until like the last 3 minutes of the episode. And I was like, yo, I'm sitting there watching the whole time. Like, if you compare him to Herbert, Perry's not that bad.
I like him better than
Perry. This was not one of the worst Perry episodes.
Yeah.
Though you got to say, from the ones that you've seen, this was, you know, this was not one of her worst. So if you want to call that a positive.
Yeah. I mean, I'd say that her best performance that I saw was at the very end of her run when she finally got interesting and then they kicked her off the show. and then this would probably be the next one down.
Yeah. And this leads me to my first plus, which is that it's just so fun to hate on Perry. She has terrible... First of all, you see my notes, like, they get, like, more and more, like, scratchy and discordant. I'm, like, getting so annoyed at her. The dialogue... like, she just says things for no reason that never come back. Like, but terrible lines. I wrote here that I worry about you. It's my caring nature. Like, the way she talks is just so hilarious. Like, you could definitely turn this into a drinking game with her. And the again, just the dinosaur puppet coming at her and stuff, like, really, it was fun. It was, I wish kind of that I'd had someone here to, like you said, Mystery Science Theater.
Yeah, that's probably, I'm sure, I didn't really look around too much for it, but I'm absolutely certain that there is there's a drinking game that goes along. Oh, yeah. No, there's got to be a drinking game for this thing. Because especially when if you don't have some sort of altering substance in your hand when you first get exposed to those Bandrill creatures, the ones they're talking to about the diplomacy, you say, well, I guess this means war, and it's like and it's this goofy looking wrinkle puppet, you know, cobra head looking thing, the slash ET. I don't even know what it was, but it horrid. That if you don't have at least some grain alcohol in your hand or something in a clip in front of you, sorry, I didn't know, then well, you're not getting the full experience here.
Oh, trust me.
Yeah, no, I was gonna say. The time lash drinking game goes, you know, when you push play, drink a fifth of vodka, pass out. That's the drinking game for this episode.
Never have to see it.
But in terms of other positives, Melissa.
Anyway,
positive stuff. Positive stuff.
We're really doing this.
Hold on. My next one is that we see the doctor legit try to kill someone. He kills the dude, and then it turns out that he's not dead. And he tries to kill him again, and it amid like a torrent of like really horrible personal insults. Like, he's so cruel to him that I'm listing this as a positive because that, like, that's interesting about the doctor's character. Like, we don't usually see him killing people anymore, but he was right. No hesitation.
Yeah, and that did get a little criticism out there from the public at large because of the fact that while, you know, the sort of the vinegar nature of a lot of Sixth Doctor's behavior or his dialogue or just his general disposition was acceptable, you know, you kind of understand where some of that came from as far as the way that his persona carried forward. When it got to the point where it became more physical, that's where you were really starting to break away from, you know, it was a stark contrast to Davison, who was, you know, such a pacifist by nature or by comparison. So yeah, a lot of people looked at that too and said, wow, he was awfully quick to try to condemn someone to death. That's a new leap.
Although,
not just, I mean, incapacitating him.
The first time that it happens, it, you know, he was using the little delayed crystal thing. It was his own shot fired back at him. So it was a very, you know, I'm going to let you kill your, you know, I'm going to let events happen that are going to lead to your demise. Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, we've seen that from the doctor plenty of times. So right. I don't feel like that's anything really new. It's just the fact that he was holding something that happened to fire back at the guy that he didn't direct somewhere else that really made it seem like he was killing him.
That's true, but I'm thinking the second incident where he, like, the things that he says to him and everything.
Oh yeah. Yeah, that was some fun stuff.
My next point is that the doctor's little scheme to... This it goes back to, like, Keir, what you were saying about how, like, the script kind of could have been good. Like, there were the seeds of some things there. I liked the doctor's use of a hologram self or something. I don't think that this episode quite did it the right way. I think that they did it the right way in the writing of River Song, 30 years later, when the doctor was in his ganger with the Tesselecta. I think it's very, very similar to the modern writing. So I thought that was, you know, a little clever thing. Again, if they had made something like that the foreground or the big story, like the thing with Herbert, it would have been a better script. It wasn't, but...
Yeah. That was kind of a little cool piece of hand waving there. I like the idea of having the broadcast image of yourself 10 seconds ahead of where you actually were, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I thought that was kind of interesting, and it would have, if you were to see that sort of thing used in New Who, it'd be something that would be set up within the first or second act, and then you'd see it applied. You know, it'd be one of those, you know, I pulled it out of my bag of tricks later on because they like to telegraph it a little better. Mm-hmm. But in this time around, you know, at least it got to the point where we're saying, okay, well, that's all right. You know, I can see you committed to that. I can see it working out the way you wanted it to. But it was just amidst so much else.
I don't, what year was this?
85, I think. Where, was it 85?
Where were we in Star Trek The Next Generation at that point? Was it? It was just prior next to gen. Yeah, next gen. It was just prior to next gen, really, wasn't it? Or just in the beginning era?
I have no idea.
No, I think the next gen came around a few years after.
Okay, yeah, it's same. Because as soon as he did the
Next Gen thing. Started airing in 87.
Okay, because as soon as he did the hologram thing or the projection, the first thing I thought of was the Picard maneuver that he came up with, where you jump to light speed real quick and put your ship real close to theirs, but they're still seeing the one back there because the light hasn't had time to travel to them. And I'm doing a horrible job of describing this. Like, as soon as it happened, the first thing I thought was, oh yeah, it's the Picard maneuver thing. Oh wait, no, that's. Maybe. I don't know. You could tell my brain was really in this episode while I was watching it.
I'm waiting for the kids to run in to tell me that they needed something. Just nobody needs anything right now? Just I don't need to make any lunches for tomorrow? Anyone? No? Okay.
May as well make them anyway.
You know what? I'm being proactive. Melissa, you had one more?
Yes.
As far as positive,
mine is the opposite of Jay. You said that in comparison to Herbert, Perry isn't that bad. I hate Perry, and I think I liked Herbert. He was, you know, he was a good, likable guy. I mean, I can't really say anything much stronger than that. But you know, as long as we're looking for positives, he was, you know, he was a nice guy. He was a nice little one episode or one story arc companion. And I put in the notes, of course, but everyone knows that H.G. Wells was a sexy warehouse agent. If anyone watches Warehouse 13, you know.
Very true. But I think one of the only reasons why I thought, you know, as far as if they were going to introduce the Herbert thing, if they were really going to carry that out and make that more of a central premise of the show, that it should have been something where Herbert was given a little bit more base intelligence. Mm-hmm. Because he just seemed a little dopey or a little kind of, you know, doe-eyed through the whole thing. Whereas if you read even, you know, 3 pages of anything that he's written, you can tell that he's functioning on a level that his peers just couldn't even possibly comprehend, regardless of his, you know, previous exposure to the Doctor. And all of his abilities, but yeah, I'll stand behind H.G. Wells on that
one.
And the last positive, you probably don't have to watch this episode again.
Yay! I've been trying to be positive about this. I really have, but it was such a chore to get through. Yeah, we joke about it, but you know, I was sitting there like, if somebody interrupts me, I'm never going to come back to this thing. I'm not going to finish it, and I'm not going to apologize about it either.
That's understandable. But you know, in retrospect, I mean, even where we are so far in this arc, I actually was able to get through Time Lash more comfortably because of just kind of the way I was approaching it than I could Terminus. I think I enjoyed Time Lash more because of the campy factor, because of the fact that it was so over the top bad. It was like one of those ones so bad it's good kind of thing, where Terminus was trying to salvage itself throughout and just kept falling on its face over and over. And I found it more boring. I know the Time Lash got a lot of criticisms for being a very thin script, being boring. I found Terminus to be more so, personally.
I can agree with that. It was, you know, it did keep you coming back just because you're like, what horrible puppet are they going to put on screen next, or how horrible is the acting going to be from the next person on screen? So it was a train wreck. You just wanted to see how bad it could get.
Yeah.
But then we decided to move on to New Who. So we're taking a look at The Curse of the Black Spot. This was the series 6. Got the Doctor and Amy and Rory come up on a pirate ship who, apparently, as soon as you are injured in any shape or form, you get snatched.
Right, by the glowy green singing hot siren. Or however Smith chose to describe her. In an evening dress. Now, to give a little bit of a backdrop, I mean, this is happening right in the middle of very intense episodes.
Yes.
I mean, this is when Series 6 was really, like, bumping along, and you had just the earliest hints of the whole Kavarian sect and everything going on, you know, and the eye patch lady keeps showing up, and everyone's kind of, you know, wondering what's going on with Amy, that she's seeing things no one else is seeing, and then all of a sudden there's this break, you know. So this was your breather episode. So somewhat.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, you still get, you know, when Amy's sleeping, she wakes up to see Madame Kavarian again, and I had forgotten that all this was going on around it.
Right.
Because, I mean, it is such a standalone episode that when she popped up, I was like, oh, okay, I had forgotten about that. You know, and then at the end with the doctor scanning her and her being pregnant, not pregnant. You know, right. It's like, those are the only real tie-ins you get in this episode.
Yeah.
And yeah, like you said, you know, if you take that into account, it's like, this would be a horrible disappointment, kind of like introducing an impossible girl and then waiting until the very last episode to give you any information about it.
You know, the only person who would do something really horrible like that is probably Stephen Moffat. Hey, wait a minute. Who wrote this episode? I believe Stephen Moffat wrote this episode.
Was it?
No, I don't think he did.
Yeah.
Oh. No.
Did he not?
He did not.
Check, please.
Google powers activate.
Verify. But it did air right before The Doctor's Wife.
I was like, oh my god, we should watch this one instead.
Well, don't we all?
No, the writer was Steve Thomas, or Thompson.
Sorry. Oh, snap. Okay. Yeah, my bad. I don't know where I picked that up from. But, all right, minus 5 points for House Hanson.
Let's just all agree to blame Moffat.
Well, but here's what I'm going to say is, you know, the criticisms out there are kind of run the gamut. A lot of people genuinely like the episode, but a lot of people, as far as, you know, holding it to a New Who standard, kind of really jumped ugly on this one for a handful of reasons. Not nearly as acidic as some of the stuff we've seen some of the classic Who attacked for, but because of the fact that it's and this is one of the things that I'm glad that a lot of the writers have also pointed out, or reviewers have also pointed out, at times we lose track of what the long view of Doctor Who is really about, and these flights of fantasy. So if you start taking it a little too seriously, it becomes difficult to enjoy the episodes that are far from serious. So you get a critique out there that says that, you know, there's absolutely no doubt that the Curse of the Black Spot is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. It's grandly and utterly ridiculous. So you get the sequence where Captain Avery sees the TARDIS console, and as he describes it, with jaundiced skepticism, rather than with the awe or horror to be expected of a 17th century pirate looking upon this, you know, otherworldly technology, is preposterous on the surface of it. But Smith and Hugh Bonneville, as Avery, remain perfectly in character and take it in their stride, even after the TARDIS sputters off into another dimension, leaving them behind in the seemingly doomed pirate ship, which, when you think about it, is equally preposterous. So it's a matter of how you look into it, you know, or how seriously you're trying to take an episode that isn't really trying to be that serious.
I was just saying this, I like when he brings an historical character or someone from the past onto the TARDIS or something, and they always take it in stride. And I, you know, this is another one of those. I'm like, I always find it very funny. And he
why do they never bring someone on and they just look around, their eyes roll back and they faint? Why does that never happen?
Right.
They're saving that for when they do the Doctor Who Sherlock crossover. John will be okay with it. Sherlock's going to be done. You did talk about how, you know, we did tend to lose sight. We had some feedback from a listener on Twitter, and I'm going to butcher your Twitter name, and I apologize in advance. It's Shimyaza Azrael said, too many fans forget how to watch the show. I've never forgotten how to be 8 years old. And I think that's that speaks to it, is we need to just be able to say, you know, every episode isn't going to be, you know, the Day of the Doctor. It's not going to be the Doctor's Wife. There's going to be some that aren't going to hit that itch, but that's not saying that, you know, it's a bad episode.
It's a legit criticism, because I think that later on they did try to make every episode a great episode, and in my opinion did not succeed at that goal. So these little filler episodes are necessary.
Well, I mean, because there are others, you know, you could look at that didn't get the same kind of general trouncing that this one did. I think it was all because of a matter of timing. But if you take something like Town Called Mercy, you know, a robo gunslinger, you know, and a twisted little, you know, previous biochemist who lands in this Western town in Mork's egg, you know, and no one really raised an eyebrow too much of that one, except us, maybe. but that's just the nature of it. Every once in a while, you got to say, okay, well, we're taking a break from this one, and we're gonna joke around with this. I think you take one of the other criticisms that happens here is that there happen to be some logic gaps. But yeah. But that's, I mean, that, okay. But then again, if you're suspending your disbelief to a certain degree and just kind of enjoying the sheer adventure, and this is just an adventure episode, you know, for all intents and purposes, you're not supposed to sit there and say, well, according to, you know, the physical nature of glass, if you break it into smaller shards, it still remains to carry its reflective qualities, and therefore the siren would still be able to... shut up. Because at that point, it doesn't matter. It's just... you know, you're grasping, our characters are grasping at straws in an act of self-preservation. Let it go. You know, the fact that the doctor's sitting there breathing on the medallion over and over again.
To fog it up, yeah.
Yeah. How long is that going to last? You know, but I get it. Which brings us along to one of the criticisms that I think could possibly stand up. And this is one that I will agree with. And that has to do with Avery's character. And I know, you know, if you want to say something nasty, that's fine. It's Kier@GallifreyPublicRadio.com. Go ahead. But one of the writers kind of called this out succinctly. We imagine that pirates, we're talking pirates here, not your, you know, I put on a foam hat for Halloween and put a plastic parrot on my shoulder. We're talking the legit pirates. Were these swashbuckling, romantic, exciting people. But in fact, they were thieves and murderers.
Mm-hmm.
But this episode tried to have its cake and eat it too. So Bonneville plays Avery as a hero who made the wrong choices, but all it takes is for his son to show up, and he suddenly gets an attack of conscience, but not enough of one to keep him, suddenly, you know, the treasure shows up and he's going to lose that last crown, and he's going to risk everyone's life because of the one crown there that's rolling across the deck. He never really repents, and the doctor never really calls him out on it. Okay, think about when he's dealt with situations like this before in things like Dinosaurs on a Spaceship. You know, everybody gets their comeuppance. So little Toby gets to live, and the pirates pretty much get away with it all. In fact, they're given a spaceship.
So 2 weeks in a row, we've got space pirates, people.
And they're all okay with it. So that, I think, might be a kind of a legitimate. But when it comes down to that, that kind of leads me right into one of my positives. As far as I'm gonna make this pun because I've been waiting to use this one. As a pirate, if he's going to be the hooker with a heart of gold, plus five. Avery is an interesting character. The idea of being someone who was sort of, you know, led to into this life rather than something that he chose might have some historical believability and plausibility to it. You know, maybe you don't set out one day and say, well, I'm a lousy sailor. I don't like following Her Majesty's Royal Navy. I'm going to become a pirate today and just go out in the docks and see if someone hires you. This is something where a lot of them probably end up backing into the profession for whatever reason. So this was kind of an interesting little story about how he kind of got, you know, roped into this or sucked into this. And while it, no, it's not entirely something you can say, oh, well, that's historically accurate. That sort of thing happens all the time. Yeah, runs away, you know, child comes back, claims him, he turns his life around, happens all the time. But it doesn't matter. I liked what Bonneville did. I thought he was kind of, you know, he put a good spin on it. I genuinely thought the 2.5 minutes or so around Rory's drowning, you know, oh my God, they killed Rory again. This time around, though, I liked the way they held this scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked what it really pulled out of Amy. I wasn't really certain how the doctor was reacting to it. I was watching his facial expressions, and Smith was putting something kind of weird into it. But from Amy alone, and the fact that they held it long enough and held that stillness long enough, had a good emotional impact. And I give him a lot of credit for not having him sputter up seawater, you know, inside of 15 seconds. You know, they really held that one out. And obviously Murray Gold in the background really kind of, you know, beating the hell out of it definitely helped. So, my two other positives here. The siren, Lily, come on, smoking.
I mean, her job is supermodel. Like, this was a gig, so.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then lastly, you know, and this is kind of goes along with what we said back at the beginning when we started talking about this. For all the fluff that they claim this one carries, or the fact that it's not really dangerous at any given point, you know, the danger was never really there because she was a doctor, or, you know, hologram or whatever all along. Just remember that that's exactly what so many of Classic Who and a great deal, really, of New Who episodes have always been. The whole idea of giving yourself, you know, 40 some odd minutes of implausibility and sheer fantasy is the core tenets of what a lot of the show was built on. But we get lost when, you know, Moffat hands us these, you know, 6 episode arcs of the most intense stuff we've seen, you know, all year, and it's just, you know, it's beat beating in our brains and our heartstrings. And we can at times lose track of the fact that, you know, you can just sit back and just kind of enjoy it for, you know, for good, bad, or ugly. It's just a romp for all intents and purposes. So this is a little reminder for us. No, it's not Shakespeare. And no, it's not the best Who episode ever written. But it's, I would not put it at the, you know, below the halfway mark as far as any sort of grand lists.
Yeah. That kind of ties in with something that I was thinking too, is, you know, we've heard, like, I know a Shooter or a Stargate Pioneer has, you know, defended Rings of Akatin repeatedly, constantly. Mm-hmm. All the time. But one of his big defenses of it is that, you know, it's full of whimsy, and I don't see it with that episode so much. I see it with this one. You know, this one feels like it fits in the Doctor Who universe, but it's more like, let's have fun with an episode. Let's see the Doctor on a pirate ship. You know, this is the kind of whimsy I look for in Doctor Who stories. You know, if it's not going to be the serious, you know, the Moffat's been writing it since his 8th birthday kind of depth, you know, this is the kind of whimsy that I want to see out of an episode. So if you're going into it looking for fun, it's, you know, it's there to be had. You just have to set aside all of your other, you know, preconceived ideas of what you're supposed to be getting.
Okay.
A lot of this episode that I enjoyed was, you know, Captain Avery, I thought, was a good character. Maybe handled a little bit improperly, but, you know, all historical inaccuracies aside, I thought it was a decent character. You know, for what we are getting in this episode, he really did help to carry the story through, and he was, you know, I enjoyed the character.
Mm-hmm. You've been done without Toby.
Well, I don't know. I feel like that was part of what made Captain Avery so, you know, understandable. You know, you had to give him something that gave him pause so that he wasn't just, you know, a right bastard the whole time. You know, because you're dealing with a pirate captain. You've got to give him some kind of something to bring him back to his humanity.
Did you ever really see him at his full piratey, though?
We didn't really get a chance because he kept on pointing the gun in the Doctor's face, so... There was that, but he continued with that even after Toby popped up. But
I wonder if it,
a lot of the lingo in that one scene where Rory was like, "We're gonna need a guidebook or something."
Yeah,
we're becalmed. But I'm wondering if they had changed around. I mean, they started off the episode slap bang with comedic elements.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the first 10 minutes are all, you know, even with when things are, oh, I'm walking the plank and whatnot, and the Doctor is soliciting, you know, I should be getting more laughter out of you guys. And they I mean, they really cut the legs out from any sort of real danger, but I think that might have been intentional. You could have ended up with a very different episode if these pirates were genuinely, you know, right bastards as they historically would have been, you know, from the get-go. But then again, as soon as you realize that they've basically been, neutered by the fact that they can't injure each other or themselves... that it, you know, maybe it makes a little bit more sense.
I swear to God, step back or I'm going to cut you. Little knife. I'm going to give you a little nick. That was kind of funny when you're first watching it and you don't know what's going on and you see them all, like, you know, really freaked out by Amy carrying a sword and you're like, really? You guys are like professional murderers. This is what you do. You know, it's like, are you really scared of her? Although I do have to say, Amy in a pirate garb, I'm good. I enjoyed that part. Wholehearted.
But it was over her flannel shirt and her jeans, you know. She's kind of slapdash.
In the first place, like, oh, I see a pirate hat and coat hanging here. Like,
because if you're going to grab a sword and go up against pirates, you're going to dress the part, damn it.
Best you could do. And of course, Rory was in full loopy mode at that point. He gets all into it. You look amazing.
He told me she should dress as a pirate more often.
I know. I gotta say, watching this, like, really reminded me how much I love Rory. You know, even when he's not badass Centurion, he's still a great character. I still love him. But yeah, there were a lot of one-liners that were great in this. You know, the Doctor talking about Freud, and, you know, he's describing him, and he's like, "Oh, very comfy couch." I just love the idea that the Doctor has spent time on Freud's couch.
And then interesting sessions.
Every time it's like, yeah, just please ignore all my other theories. What, again?
Yeah, him having to constantly remind himself that he's, you know, a couple hundred years before he can use any of the references for the things he's trying to explain.
Yeah, I want to use dimensionally transcendental, but seeing as you got hung up on sensors, I'm not going to do that. But yeah, and then Rory, like you said, Kier, you know, the whole Rory dying again and the emotions that we do get out of that, because I mean this has been a fun romp kind of episode. You know, it hasn't been properly scary. It hasn't, you know, even when the stakes seem kind of high, you still know that everything's not that horrible. You know, so then you get to the end and we've been okay, and then Rory's dying, and you're right, they do hold it long enough, because it's you're sitting there like, okay, this has been a fun episode. They're gonna drag Rory into the TARDIS, he's gonna be okay, and he's not breathing yet. Amy, stop crying, he's not breathing yet. This is getting real. This is holy crap, they killed Rory. Yeah, and they do drag it out just long enough to where you're able to come down off the funny high and the, you know, and really take it as seriously as it needs to be taken. So just brilliant on that part.
Yeah, they definitely do let that hang for a good amount of time.
Yeah. So, Melissa, what do you got on this?
I mean, so the thing is, like, I remembered this episode as being better than it was upon this viewing. So I did not have much.
She actually went down.
Really did. Like, so I don't really have much good to say, and most of my points we've already covered. I liked Captain Avery, but I think that I liked more of how he was played by the actor rather than the writing, because as has been pointed out, he had no redemption at the end, and he kept learned to fly a pirate ship in space in like 5 minutes. But I liked the character insofar as I think it was the actor doing it more than the writing.
He was a great actor. I give you that. Yeah. That carried a lot of it. I don't think the character would have been nearly as interesting had they miscast it.
Yeah.
No, Bonneville's got a lot of cred.
Yeah. And that, like, one of the things that I thought was that there was racial diversity among the pirates. I was really, really reaching here. But of course the black guy gets the spot first. So, you know, you had a plus and a minus there.
It's not necessarily true. The first guy that we see dying is white, at the very beginning.
That's different.
I'm trying to redeem it, damn it.
And again, as long as we're objectifying Amy, sorry, Karen Gillan, like, her hair looked fabulous in this, like, until it was all soaking wet. I was the whole time like, how is it so bouncy and shiny all the time?
It's because it's Karen Gillan, that's how, that's her superpower.
So she shaved her head, so she's like Samson, she lost her superpower. But yeah, that is all that I have to say about this episode. We you guys already mentioned all the other good stuff. That's me. I love Rory. But again, if you don't know Rory, like, you might not like him so much in this episode. Like, I feel like we were already fans of him going in, so, like, you know, you got all verklempt when he dies. But if you weren't like a Rory lover, you know, this episode might be meh.
Yeah, this episode wouldn't win anyone over on Rory, I don't think. But it's if you're a fan of him, you can appreciate him. If not, he's there. And he dies again. You got that to look forward to.
Was this the first? No.
No.
Oh, no.
No, this was like 9 or 12 on the list. I lost count somewhere in the double digits.
I'll have to look at my Rory death timeline. But no, this is one of the ones I think that had one of the greatest emotional impact, because at this point they're not only they're a couple, they're married, and with the conception now in place, or what we now know in retrospect was the first glimpses of that. Did we ever really get a justification for why the doctor just kind of blatantly scanned her? Stand still for a second. I just go whoop, nothing.
Yeah. She had said something in Day of the Moon, I think, somewhere in that two-parter in the Impossible Astronaut Day of the Moon, she had said something about her being pregnant, and it was in a really tense moment. The doctor came back. He's like, what was that you were saying? She's like, nothing. So she had mentioned it before and then dropped it. So he was probably just trying to figure out what was going on.
Gotcha.
But yeah, so I feel like we didn't get as much out of these as we did last week. Well, maybe a little bit more out of Time Lash, but
well, it depends on what it is that you're going for here. Yeah. I mean, if we're trying to come back and say, no, it's not all that bad, or what have you, you're getting one thing. If you're trying to say, you know what, then this episode has really taken a bum rap, well, then that's a far tougher defense.
Yeah.
I would say in these cases, well, maybe more so with Time Lash, these are ones where, yes, it is bad. We're going to give you that. But it doesn't mean it's unwatchable. It's watchable because it's bad.
Right.
yeah. then, you know, that's take number one. Curse of the Black Spot, I think it's just a matter of, you know, it's a matter of the evaluation that it took in context of
yeah.
where it was in the season, you know, where we were with the characters. It's just, you know,
I think had this been somewhere in like season five, before the Angel two-parter, mm-hmm. I think it would have been better. Yeah, if it had been in there somewhere where it wasn't, where you weren't chomping at the bit trying to figure out what was going on. I mean, the doctor's dead. We've got to deal with that. Amy is, you know, having these hallucinations and all this stuff. If you're not trying to get information on that, then you can enjoy this episode a lot more. If you're still in the middle of those mysteries and you get handed this, it's, yeah, it's very much like, yeah, like we've just dealt with at the end of series 7, where you want to know more about Clara and they keep handing you these episodes that have nothing to do with it, and it was just infuriating us the whole time, you know.
Right. Yep.
So, yeah.
Well, we're not done.
No, we're not. Yay.
No, it gets worse. Well, I wouldn't say it necessarily gets worse, but we're not going to let up on this. Because as we said, you know, we're treating this fairly. We're looking to both Classic Who and New. And while by our standards, we might consider New Who to be kind of a little less susceptible to these kind of stark criticisms, it is by no means fully protected. So what are we diving into next week, kids?
Next week for the classic episode, we're going to be taking a look at the Twin Dilemma. So yes, we're going with the Sixth Doctor again, but this is another one of those that is, you know, systematically put towards the bottom of the list, and we feel like it really needs to be delved and see what we can dig out of it. Because correct me if I'm wrong, this is actually the one where the Doctor like strangles Perry, right?
Yes, I know. From the moment we first started discussing this one, that was your one positive. Well, I got positive number one.
Yeah, exactly.
Perry gets a life choked out of her.
So yeah, we've got that, and then for the New Who, we're going to be taking a look at the Idiot's Lantern.
Yeah, for those of you who don't
into the TVs,
yes. TV show face sucking end of list. That's pretty much all.
So all right, yeah. So I'm looking forward to next week. Yay!
Sure you are.
I try. But now we do have a little bit of news, though. Nothing real major, but yeah, we've already talked about how Stephen Moffat has come out saying that series 8 is going to be run in one chunk. It's going to be a solid, you know, 14 episode run or something. I think it's 14 episodes. I can't remember now.
I believe so.
I think it might be 14, including the Christmas special, but that wouldn't be part of the same run. Anyway.
With the interruption, you're right. 14 produced episodes for that. Yeah.
Yeah. And the series proper is all going to be in one lump, and that it's probably going to be coming out somewhere in August. I don't think it's been confirmed. It says it's expected in August. So then there's a. We've also got confirmation now that Series 9 is going to be following the same template.
Correct.
And it's going to be coming out. Yeah, it's going to be coming out in 2015.
We'll have it within calendar year 2015, yeah, which is good, because it means at least between that and some of the news also from the Moffat camp about potentially seeing at least the UK release of Season 4 of Sherlock by Christmas of 2014, means that all of this time that he has taken to get these things locked down and on their feet means that he's either really feels that he's got a grasp on it, and they've been laying out some of these more long-term calendars with some degree of certainty, or maybe he's letting go of the reins on certain things and allowing some of his supporting crew and talent to help him see these things through without taking eons to get them finished, a la, you know, George R. R. Martin or something like that.
Right.
The other little things out there, for those of you who haven't been sort of watching some of the Twitter streams and so forth, the new production photos from the set that are involving Capaldi on horseback, running around in a nightgown in period England, the Paternoster gang in mm-hmm. full effect there.
Strax
in a fascinating hat.
Yes.
Over his armor and wearing the uniform, some sort of a beret and weird suit with his Centauran armor clearly visible beneath, looking rather lumpy and stuffed into it. Should be interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting quotes that came about from Capaldi talking about the experiences, and he came forth in talking about what he's bringing to the role of the Doctor. interesting some of his choice of words. He's sort of poking at himself, saying, well, this clearly isn't going to have any sort of these sort of boyfriend relationships. You've had a couple of, your last two doctors have been boyfriend doctors, and I'm far too old for that nonsense. So you're going to have someone who's a little sterner, more irritable, madder. And I don't mean mad in the angry sense. He means like Mad Hatter kind of, which could be a real interesting blend of character traits to bring into this. I'm thinking mm-hmm. sort of something where you've got the wildness or the unpredictability of Troughton, along with the serious kung fu business of Pertwee, but then you've got the straight up wackiness and joie de vivre of Tom Baker. So second, third, fourth, all in a blend there. That could be really, really cool.
Yeah, it could. I mean, and that's one thing I kind of expect to see is when you get people on the show who are fans of the show for a long time, you can see traits of their favorite doctors come out in their performance. With David Tennant, we saw there's some parallels to be drawn with Peter Davison. So it's very, very interesting to see that, and I wouldn't at all be surprised to see him bring in a lot of the characteristics that we're used to from Classic Who.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Oh, and one last little piece of news here. Well, it's not really news for a great number of our viewers, but a few of them out there. J-Bob, if you're listening as well. Forbidden Planet has just announced that come the end of January, they're going to be releasing a lot more replicas, and you may or may not be able to put in a pre-order with the UK for a Fifth Doctor and an Eighth Doctor screwdriver, which I may or may not have already purchased today. So those of us who have been building display cabinets for our screwdriver collections now have to install two more shelves, and I'm pretty damn psyched about that. So head over to Forbidden Planet and look at—they got a whole bunch of new swag. So go warm up your credit card.
Kier, you just recently got the 11 Doctor story box set or a book.
Yes, the 11 Doctors 11 Stories. It just arrived the day before yesterday. Amazon was able to get it out a couple of weeks prior to their original ship date, and I'm already starting to tear into Yoan Colfer's first story on the First Doctor. Loving it. It's actually, when you put it all together in print form for that tome, I mean, there's a lot of reading in there, but I can't wait. And I've got other people who saw it sitting on the coffee table said, when you're done, would you mind if I just, I'll have it back in a week, I promise. But I can't wait.
Yeah. So if you're interested in getting it, go over to the show notes and grab them there. It's going to be GallifreyPublicRadio.com/69. It'll be there'll be a link in the show notes for you to go to. So go check that out. Get it, because I know I've already I'm waiting my tax return as soon as these get most of it's already blown on stuff like this. It's sitting in my wish list waiting for me to push the buy button.
Excellent.
So I think that's about all we've got for news.
Yes, sir.
So come back next week. We'll tear into the Twin Dilemma and the Idiot's Lantern. But this has been episode 69 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, yeah, Colin Baker, you need to seriously record some insults for people's voicemails. That would be brilliant.
And this is Melissa saying, I am getting Homicidal Mermaid put on my business cards.
And this is Kier saying, bad, bad, bad. It's disastrous.
We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows by calling 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1477 to leave us a voicemail. You can head to GallifreyPublicRadio.com to leave comments on each episode. There you can also keep up to date on all the latest news and gossip, as well as what's going on in the community. Also make sure to head over to GunnaGeek.com to find out lots of other high-quality, geek-centric shows. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2014.